This is Regionally Speaking, Reporters Roundtable Thursday. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us. And let's thank now Bill Dolan with the Times of Northwest Indiana. He is one of our first reporters to check in and give us an idea of the stories that he had worked on and got out there in print and online. Bill, as always, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you've had some great stories. In fact, one I can personally relate with. I got mine in the mail, and you've gotten yours, I'm sure. The reassessment notices have gone out from the counties, I guess, here in Northwest Indiana. And if you're not happy with what the assessment is, now's the time to appeal, I understand.
Yes. Reassessment goes on regularly, but at this time of the year is when they send out the notices for what they've been doing for a while. And that amounts to about $60,000 in Lake and $90,000 in Porter County. Reassessment is essentially where the county or township assessor goes out to your house and eyeballs it, see if it's still as big as it used to be or maybe bigger, and the condition of it, if it's been improved in any way. And they go over their that all feeds into a property card, which eventually goes into the calculation of its worth for taxing purposes. And the notices are sent out, and frankly, many of them are going up by at least 4%, sometimes much more. And that's a function of value rising because of the real estate market and just people adding on to their homes.
I understand recently that the Porter County assessor said that because they've had more of a increase in assessment values because you say that that there have been more people out there that have sold homes, properties worth more, and that does count for something when it's time to sell your home, I understand.
Yes, let me remind our readers of the Times that we will be following this up with a more detailed story on rising property assessments and what that means. But essentially, the market is been shooting up in recent years from the depths of the Great Recession, but there haven't been a lot of new homes built. So the demand is outpacing the supply, and so prices are going up for each individual home and business, and that all feeds into the overall trending, which means your assessment rises. Now, assessors are quick to remind people that don't have a heart attack if you see that you're up a large percent, because it doesn't mean your taxes will go up that high. They will go up, but there are other factors involved that could mitigate that rise in assessment.
I suppose too, is it depends if a particular your school district that you happen to live in, if they are seeking a referendum vote on any issues that if they do succeed from the voter's standpoint, that it's going to mean more taxes will have to be raised to be able to pay for the things that they've asked for. So I guess that's where you might definitely see an increase in your taxes.
Yeah, and that would have nothing to do with your assessment. That's
right.
Strictly a fact of local government, in this case schools, requiring more money for paychecks for teachers or for capital projects like new buildings.
Now, you had in your story that ran in print and online some information that people should take note of if they do indeed really want to file an appeal. I know that in Lake and Porter counties, you have more time. I guess LaPorte County, I think I got the impression that the appeals period is over in LaPorte County, but if you do want to appeal and you do want to have an appeal of your assessment, you do have, I guess, an opportunity to do so, and you have a special form, a new form, I understand, that you have to fill out.
Yeah, Form 130, which is available online, or just walk into your local assessor's office, and they'll have them. For Lake County taxpayers, the deadline is August 27. Porter County taxpayers, September 7. And as you said, LaPorte had its notices out earlier this year,
yeah.
So that period is over. But, of course, there will be another period coming up in the coming year.
Well, I imagine that you mentioned here at the start of our conversation about the fact that the assessor's staff tend to go around and they inspect properties to make sure that the dimensions are the same. Nothing's really changed from the last time it was up for assessment. I suppose that probably there's some people that probably worry about if they've added a chicken coop to their backyard, they might get that tacked on too.
Yeah, although in many cases, as we were just saying, new construction is down, so a lot of people have decided to improve the homes that they now have, additions, what have you. And sometimes the previous assessment was just wrong. And now it's being corrected, and was artificially too low. That's what some the assessor may argue in some cases. But again, property owners have the potential to argue their case. I happen to know one case, which you'll read about in a future story, where a gentleman decided that his assessment was too high. He had a surveyor over, and he found out that his square footage was being overstated by the assessor, and he got a considerable reduction. So there is always hope for the disgruntled taxpayer.
I was thinking the same thing, too. Yeah, that's you know, people make mistakes, and then we have, of course, if you want to be really cynical about it, you can say that, well, maybe things got jacked up in spite because somebody, it's because of politics or something. Who knows? Some dispute with somebody about something or another could have led to maybe to an inflation of those figures. You never know.
Well, there have been complaints in Calumet Township that those assessments are artificially high to crank out as much taxes as possible in that township because, of course, Gary's in it and collections are so low. Of course, the Calumet Township assessor says that's not true at all, and take your pick.
Well, if that were the case, if they say that's not true, then you should be able to file an appeal and win.
You can file an appeal with your local assessor. If that doesn't work, Lake and Porter County have appeals boards that you can go to and argue, go over the head of your assessor and argue. And if you're really still having problems, you can go to the state.
Yeah.
That's a little more complicated and probably more expensive, but there is an appeal process.
Now, one of the other stories, and I'll let you explain this because you've written two stories, one following the other here with one, I guess, an update of the first. This is dealing with going back to the question of political district redistricting, the issue that has come up here that's gotten not only Indiana Secretary of State Connie Lawson involved, we understand now Hammond Mayor Tom McDermott Jr. Tell us how the city of Hammond fits into all of this and about the little mistakes apparently that were made that led to your two stories.
Well, we have a deadline coming up at the end of this month, Tuesday, for the state to reorganize precincts. Precincts are kind of an artificial subdivision. Sometimes it's as small as a few blocks. Sometimes it can contain many square miles if it's out in the country and few people live there. But they're all supposed to contain equal numbers of voters. And that's just for the purposes of setting up polling booths and serving the voters on election day. Well, the state General Assembly has felt that Lake County has way too many precincts and have decided to cut them. And the city of Hammond could lose 70% of their precincts. They would be merged together with one another. And that could mean that voters have to go to a different place to vote, travel a little farther. Gary could lose as many as 80% of its precincts. The cause of this is simply over the decades, a lot of people who used to live in Gary, Hammond, and East Chicago have moved to the suburbs, but the precinct map was never adjusted for that migration. And it's difficult because, of course, when you merge, you lose a precinct committeeman, and a precinct committeeman don't like to be put out of work. So local election officials have been reluctant to do so. The General Assembly has decided that it's time for the state to do it and save money on polling workers on election day.
Mm-hmm. And I guess Mayor McDermott, obviously, he was. I guess he's had meetings with Secretary of State Lawson, I understand, and they seem to have gotten some of the concerns at least addressed. And maybe had a chance to speak out, I guess, when each other explained their views.
This has been a several-year process,
yeah.
And Secretary of State Connie Lawson announced about a week and a half ago that she was about ready to make a decision. She had asked for input from Lake County leaders and had gotten none. Well, Mayor McDermott said he read this and decided that he would put his two cents in. He did speak with the Secretary of State on the phone and thought that he would have a follow-up meeting earlier this week. But when he arrived in Indianapolis for the follow-up meeting, he found out that Connie Lawson wasn't in the office, and he got pretty upset and told us at the Times. And then Ms. Lawson read about that and decided to have a follow-up telephone conference, but Mayor McDermott couldn't be brought to the phone for that. But it seems like they have patched up that their personal differences on this. Mm-hmm. But of course, Ms. Lawson will still probably be cutting a number of precincts in the city of Hammond. And Mayor McDermott is warning that there could very well be a federal lawsuit by disgruntled voters if in fact they do that. And he said he was just trying to help Ms. Lawson. He wishes her well, but that she better be careful because there could be lawsuits in the future.
Well, and that would be a case that it would get the impression that that Mayor McDermott would not be involved in such a federal lawsuit that if ever is filed, that he'll probably want to step aside and let the matter get handled that way.
There's plenty of people who love to sue. Yes, he said he has no intention of doing so. But in fact, there was a lawsuit filed last year by the NAACP on grounds that minority voters were being disproportionately disadvantaged by this reorganization. That was, in fact, dismissed last month because nothing had actually been done. But now that the Secretary of State is about ready to issue an order next week, that could very well be revived, and there could be additional lawsuits by others. Probably Democratic political leaders. We have to look at the political realities here. State elected leaders are primarily Republican, and they're going to be cutting precincts in a primarily Democratic city of Hammond, Gary, and East Chicago.
One last story, Bill, we wanted to cover here while we have you is to talk about the question that came up here an announcement that came up here from Lake County Prosecutor Bernard Carter recently about deciding not to charge a former county jail nursing director who just happens to be very, very close to former Sheriff John Buntzich for any involvement that dates back to the recent trial that Mr. Buntzich went through.
Yes, that's Deborah Back. Deborah Back was the nursing director for the Lake County Jail under former Sheriff John Buntzich and also happened to be his girlfriend. That came out in court earlier this year when Sheriff Buntzich was being sentenced. Assistant U.S. Attorney Philip Benson, the federal prosecutor, charged Deborah Back with having used the jail's database, the police database. It's called the Spillman system. It's,
yeah.
All police reports feed into this, and the sheriff apparently had asked her and others to look into the witnesses that were against him when he was first charged back in late 2016. And, of course, that's an abuse of the system. It's not meant for personal vendettas. It's that's for official police work. And the federal prosecutor accused her of essentially trying to spy on the government witnesses. And, again, that's not what the system's used for. And now, of course, Sheriff Buntzich was convicted of bribery, is now in federal prison. His replacement, Oscar Martinez, basically barred Deborah Back from entering the jail to ever have any contact with the Spillman system again. The matter was whether or not she had violated a law was referred to the Lake County prosecutor. And he decided July 13th in his announcement that there was no basis for a prosecution because she was she had been ordered by former Sheriff Buntzich to do this. So she would have a pretty stiff defense that she was just following the orders of the sheriff.
Well, Bill, thank you very much for spending time with us to talk about the stories that you had in print and online, and we'll look for these other stories in particular, the ones that you have told us about that readers will have a chance to come and look at in the Times on the assessment situation. Bill Dolan is the county government reporter and covers some crime issues that come up in the county as well for the Times of Northwest Indiana. And as always, Bill, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. This is Regionally Speaking Reporters Roundtable Thursday. We're talking now with Giles Bruce, who's a reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana, about the stories that he has put out in print and online in late editions here. And Giles, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Chris.
Let's get started first talking about the incident, and this kind of led up to more stories, I know, too. In fact, I think it was a kind of a group effort from the Times to look into this further earlier in the week here. It started off, I guess, with a search for a swimmer, and tell us how that seems to kind of update into things where people should know, if they don't already, that it's very dangerous to go swimming in Lake Michigan.
Well, this happened Monday night. There was a call put out that a woman was had gone missing. So they got out the search crews, the Indiana Department of Natural Resources, Lake County, Marine units, Gary Police, Gary Fire, Coast Guard. Everybody responded. There were divers looking for her. Helicopters. Officials on jet skis. This woman and two of her friends were in the water, and some currents and high waves, took them out, started taking them out deeper and deeper into the water. I spoke to a gentleman who was there with his two daughters and his girlfriend. He saw it happening. He went in. He was able to grab the guy, swim out and grab the guy. One of the other women was able to pull herself back to shore, and he kind of helped her back on the beach. But the third woman was so far out, and then she just, after a point, just disappeared, and he couldn't see her. And the conditions were bad that day, and then they were in about the week prior to that. Very high waves, 3 to 6 feet. These rip currents, which can take you right out, deep into the water, and keep taking you out. Those were happening. The National Weather Service had put out a beach hazard statement that day, telling people not to swim because of the life-threatening conditions. Some beaches had been closed in that prior week. The beach at Gary wasn't one of them, at Marquette Beach there, where this all happened. And then there was, I talked to some people at the scene who said they didn't really know, because there weren't any, they didn't see any warning flags or signs. Apparently at the beach there, they do put up some signs and flags, but then they, remove the flags when the lifeguards leave, the city told me, and that's at 6 o'clock. And this all happened about 7:30 or so. Mm-hmm. There are, websites people can check ahead of time, the National Weather Service, but, how many people actually do that is, who knows. But, the conditions were dangerous, and this, unfortunately, a 24-year-old woman from Maryville died because of it.
I wonder if there have been similar problems. You say we've focused here in the particular because of these incidents that have happened there at Marquette Beach and Gary. I wonder if along the way, further up the coastline, so to speak, like in Hammond and other places like that, if they've had problems that they've tried to resolve as well.
Yeah. Actually, the same day that this happened, I was working on a story on some incidents in Michigan City in that prior week, where they had three people nearly drown to death, and they had to be rescued either by bystanders or lifeguards. The conditions there were bad. They had red flags. They had the swimming area closed, but people were still going to this beach there at Washington Park in Michigan City. One night there were two young girls near the pier, who were in distress and in the water and about to drown, and a couple of gentlemen who were actually guys who are trained in this kind of thing, lifeguards, happened to be there, and they jumped in and saved him. And then another gentleman went back a few days later. A guy went in the water when the beach was closed, and he started getting sucked in, and the lifeguards went out and saved him. So the conditions were pretty bad, and people, when there are warnings, people sometimes ignore them. Some of the beaches, Hammond for one, that beach is a little more secure. It has a 24/7 security, a guard station you have to go through. So they close the beach there sometimes when it's dangerous, and it seems to be more effective at a more contained beach like that, where they can more easily keep people out. But all the beaches have different policies for when they close and what kind of warnings they put up. So we had that in a story that was in the paper yesterday.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Giles Bruce, who's a reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana, about the stories that he's had out there in print as well as online. You typically cover news on the health beat, and I know one story that you had recently, it was following up on the Indiana opioid epidemic, and it involved a group and a person I happened to have a chance to actually interview too. We're talking about the group of the Indiana chapter of the Addiction Policy Forum. Tell us about the report they have put out and what they've been recommending.
The Addiction Policy Forum is a national group dedicated to reducing opioid overdose deaths, started by a parent of a child who died of a opioid overdose, something that's very, very common in society today. In 2016, 1,500 Hoosiers died from drug overdoses, and about half were related to opioids. Mm-hmm. So that's essentially two people in the state die every day from opioid overdoses. But this group, they did some research, talking to public health officials and lawmakers and families of people with addiction, and they put out a blueprint, some recommendations to fix this crisis. As you mentioned, the woman who runs the group is named Justin Phillips. She co-chairs the group. She also runs the Overdose Lifeline organization that works on this issue. They do a lot of training of showing people how to use Narcan, which is the drug that you can use to reverse opioid overdoses, and they try to get that in the hands of people across the state. Phillips, she was in Indianapolis. She lost her 20-year-old son to a heroin overdose in 2013. But they had some suggestions. Some of them, they want to involve patients and their families more in the response to the crisis, expand the availability of medication-assisted treatment, which are things like Suboxone and Methadone, improve insurance coverage for drug treatment, address the needs of pregnant women and postpartum women with substance abuse disorder, greater protect Good Samaritans who come to the aids of people who report overdoses, increase the availability of needle exchanges where people with addiction can get clean needles, helping people who are getting out of jail, people with addiction who are getting out of jail to access drug treatment services. So they had quite a wide range of recommendations. A lot of them aren't, necessarily new ideas or things that are known. It's just a matter now of actually implementing them.
Giles, I know one of the stories that you had recently here as well, too, talked about the continuing effort of our local healthcare systems to continue to find ways to work together, not necessarily consolidation, although I know that there has been an attempt at a failed merger here some time ago, but the latest is involving, once again, Methodist Hospitals and Franciscan Alliance. Tell us about your story there, please.
Even into early this year, the talks between Franciscan Alliance and Methodist Hospitals were happening. The two hospital systems were considering a merger. Methodist Hospitals is a two-hospital system. They have the campuses in Gary and Maryville. They're one of the, our smaller healthcare systems here in the region, and it's increasingly harder for, small independent systems to remain that way because of, the way that healthcare is going, people spend less time in hospitals, so they're making less money. You know, insurers are getting bigger, so it's harder for smaller systems to negotiate with them, things like that. So Methodist, you know, for over a year now, they've been looking for a partner, and they've got very close to merging with Franciscan Alliance, which is, you know, one of the bigger systems, the second biggest one here in the region. You know, so they talked for quite a while. There were talks that Franciscan was going to build a new $300 million hospital in Gary, along 8094 at by IUN there. But those talks broke down. They couldn't come to an agreement. So now Methodist is still looking for other options, still looking for a partner, still looking for different joint ventures. They recently partnered with University of Chicago for that medical system to bring some of its cardiac surgeons to Northwest Indiana. Methodist is working to provide telepsychiatry, basically virtual psychiatrist visits, because there's a lack of psychiatrists in the region. They're bringing pharmacy services to Gary for outpatients, trying to implement some, bringing a new radio surgery tool, for instance, some new technology. They're also, you know, mentioned that they're going to have to do some cost cutting because it's hard, like I said, you know, they're, you know, making less and less money. It's harder for small systems to stay afloat, so they're going to have to adjust staffing and consolidate services, things like that, over the next year, you know, in the meantime, while they continue to look for a partner.
Well, it looks like more stories ahead, to be sure, with both Franciscan Alliance and with the Methodist Hospitals. And we've been talking with Giles Bruce, who's a reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana, about his stories that have shown up not only in print, but also online in recent days. And Giles, as always, thanks for being with us here on Regionally Speaking today.
Yeah, my pleasure.
There's been a lot of discussion in recent months and even in the last few years about trying to help build a strong and educatable workforce to be able to take on the jobs of the future here in Indiana. Some of the work is being left, of course, to public schools to try to make revisions in the state's graduation requirements. And that is how the Indiana State Board of Education has gotten involved here, to find a way to help come up with employability skills. And in turn, there's been some changes that are being proposed, some recommendations being made on graduation pathways. That's what the State Board of Education is working on. And we have with us Northwest Indiana's representative on the State Board of Education, Tony Walker. Tony, thank you for being with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Good afternoon, Chris.
Thank you, and good afternoon to you. Will you kind of give us a little history lesson here on the concerns that have been voiced over the years, or at least certainly before the State Board of Education, about coming up with a workforce that is able to tackle the jobs and the tasks of the future, and how that kind of relates back to how the high schools in Indiana should be dealing with it?
And this was sort of an interesting history, because typically education policy bubbles up to the state level from the field, from the schools and school districts. But this one, I believe, really came more from industry and came from the employers in the state talking to the elected officials about their troubles filling jobs in the state of Indiana and about the skills of the workforce in Indiana that were showing some concern to a lot of major companies throughout the state that looked to hire workers. And as a result of that, the governor and the State Board of Education and the Indiana General Assembly also came to the conclusion that we needed to change the expectation of high schools in Indiana as to what type of education they're providing kids, and not totally overhaul it and throw out the baby with the bathwater, but right, to make sure that when kids walk across that stage and a diploma is put in their hand, that they can actually do something. Right now, this previously and still right now, the system is sort of slanted toward higher education. But as we know, not all kids are going to go to college, and not all kids are going to even get two-year degrees. So what we as a state board tried to do with graduation pathways is make the high schools responsible for assuring that every student that graduates has some skill set that will allow them to either go on to college or go into the workforce.
When did the State Board of Education get involved in this conversation? Obviously, it's a conversation that started a long time ago in maybe the individual school districts around the state, or in the state employment agencies and the like, that decided this is the people that we have to work with, and these are the jobs that have to be filled, but the education skills are not there as they should be. When was the discussion first brought up, as best as you can tell?
Well, really, you know, education policy is really controlled by the governor of the state. So the conversation's been going on for many, many years under many different governors. But it was Governor Holcomb, when he came in, that really said, we're going to address this issue and make it a priority. And within his first year, the state board actually changed the policy and the graduation requirements to put graduation pathways out front.
Tell us how the system is set up right now with recommendations that have been made and ones that have been offered that I guess the State Board of Education will consider in more detail later if need be. How the graduation pathway seems to be shaped up right now?
Well, we've had a tremendous outpouring of support and participation from educators all throughout the state in putting together what we just adopted last week as a guidance document to school districts to actually implement graduation pathways. I mean, there was a phenomenal number of educators and school districts participating in the development of that doctrine. And where we're at now is trying to encourage school districts to not wait until, you know, for the two-year period or so when it has to be implemented, and try to set systems up now and start forming partnerships with local industry, partnerships with local nonprofits to provide the work-based learning and service-based learning experiences for kids immediately. It's being phased in. So right now, for instance, this graduating class still had to pass our examination in order to get their diploma. Otherwise, they'd have to get a waiver. So we're getting rid of that one-size-fits-all kind of testing out of high school requirement. And so you won't have that test now that you have to pass to graduate, at least the statewide test. And instead, we're looking now for more hardcore evidence that you have developed not only work experience, but service-based experience and project-based learning experiences, which hopefully will help students develop not only hard skill sets, but soft skill sets that would make them have a smoother transition either into the workforce or into college.
If you will, take us down the options here in a little more detail here. You mentioned starting out about the work-based learning. Tell us more about that and what you're hoping with the employability skills that's put these benchmarks into place, how state school systems as well as the employers can take advantage of that.
And that's going to be part of the challenge of the implementation, particularly in some of our smaller districts in more rural areas. I don't think we'll have as tough a time with implementation here, but sort of what the expectation is that school districts will start forming partnerships with local industry, whether it's U.S. Steel or whatever is in your area, particular area, to develop some opportunities for students to come in and perform internships, for them to get together, say, with United Way, have a partnership with United Way, where maybe they go and help do some service projects in their area, where all of that now is credited towards the graduation requirements for public service experiences that the student has, work-based learning experiences that the student has. And then also we're encouraging the school districts within the classroom to move to more of a project-based learning experience and move away from the model slowly but surely of just sitting students in the classroom and talking to them for 55 minutes or 60-minute period and then sending them home with homework, and looking to have it to be more of a hands-on interdisciplinary experience while they're in the classroom, facilitated by the teacher.
Now, I recall when I was in high school, I had opportunities, and some of my fellow students had the opportunities to take advantage of being able to get your classwork done a little early and then take off as long as you were going to a job of some type. Is that something that's being emphasized again to encourage the fact that school districts make room for students to be able to have a job? It might be a benefit to them to what they can learn to be able to find a career in the future?
Yeah, and I think you've just touched upon what's going to be one of the probably biggest challenges in implementing it, is that we're going to have to relook at how schools do their scheduling, whether or not they use block scheduling or whatever kind of scheduling format, to make room for students to be in and out of the building throughout the course of the day. So I think in many ways it's going to go back to what you just explained your experience was, but even probably more of that.
Do you think that even with the changes that are being proposed here to go to opportunities where you've got pathway options like work-based learning, as we've just kind of referred to here, where you have a chance to not only take your classes in school, but also go work in the afternoons, we'll say, at some job. And then service-based learning, as you mentioned, being involved in a civic or a volunteer experiences along with your classroom training. And then of course, the project-based learning, which is what you're hoping to go to. Will this change anything dramatically, in your opinion, based on what the current pathway is? That is, that, and we know that it's kind of veering off a bit, to go into a pathway where a graduate will in turn get his high or her high school diploma or certificate of some kind, and that will then kind of aim them perhaps toward higher education, but hopefully first be ready for a job.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a dramatic change because you're going to have more and more students graduating, number one, with college credits, because part of this also is really trying to focus on dual credit programs, which I think are really going to pick up as a result of this as well. So I think you'll have more and more kids, particularly in their junior or senior years, maybe spending part of the day at their high school and then part of the day at Ivy Tech or Indiana University Northwest or Purdue Northwest. So you're going to have a lot more of that going on. But you're also going to have kids that are now not only graduating with a diploma, but are graduating with industry certifications, which will allow them to go and get much more higher paying jobs within the state of Indiana.
And do you think this is also a given opportunity, maybe people hadn't thought of before, to be involved in apprenticeships for some of the trades that still offer apprenticeships?
Absolutely. And that's one of the things that I'm working on right now with our state board. Because currently we don't have a technical education concentrator in plumbing and pipe fitting.
Right.
So I'm trying to establish now in the state of Indiana a pathway for plumbing and pipe fitting. Because I have a lot of friends that are plumbers and pipe fitters, and you know what? They're always in demand.
Well, that's what you would think.
The world, apparently.
We're noticing that there's always a demand for plumbers and pipe fitters. There's always a demand for well experienced carpenters and joiners and some of the other trades, construction trades in particular. We want to see more houses go up, more office buildings go up, and then get them filled. But somebody has to build those.
Absolutely. And that's one of the first meetings I'm looking forward to have is with Northwest Indiana Building Trades Council. As soon as we can get the foundation set and the state approval for having a plumbing and pipe fitting pathway, to see if we can come up with some program that is sort of a precursor to entering into the union trades program up here.
We're talking with Tony Walker, who is Northwest Indiana's representative on the Indiana State Board of Education. The Board of Education is dealing with graduation pathways options that are being made available and being discussed these days. We've talked about the way to help make young people more employable in the workforce as they finish up their high school and maybe some college experience to get a certificate of some type. What kind of changes, if any, are planned in the options for those who are maybe actually going to continue on and head on to college? Any changes in the benchmarks that they're facing, the SATs, the ACTs, the other exams they might have to face?
There are changes that I think are going to really help our graduating college-bound seniors. One, for instance, we're looking at changing our 10th grade standardized test to the actual SAT. And hopefully we'll be able to work it out with the General Assembly for the state to actually cover the cost for students to take that SAT. The other thing, or SAT, ACT, or one of those tests, it hasn't been determined which one yet.
Uh-huh.
But I'm just saying the ones that people know.
I'm sure that there are probably a lot of details that have yet to be worked out, that a lot of this has had some good options that have been offered, but in the discussion, the recommendations that have been made, but you have to come down to actually how to practice this.
Yeah, and the other thing is we're really looking to have strong partnerships with our local state universities. I mean, Ivy Tech has been a great partner, as has Purdue, Northwestern, IUN. So I think there will be more linkages between the local school districts and those universities to assist kids to get more college credits while still in high school. And there's one school, 21st Century Charter School in Gary, that actually pays the fees for their students to take those courses. I don't know how many other school districts actually do that, but that's a possibility. But in every case, those fees are subsidized, and they're cheaper to accrue. It's cheaper to accrue those college credits on a high school dual credit track than it is if you were actually enrolled in the college. So you get the added benefit of, I think you're going to have a lot more high schoolers graduating with a year and maybe some of them even 2 years of college credit under their belt that have been either significantly subsidized or paid for them.
Tony, you're here in Northwest Indiana, so you get to see an area that is still, even though it's reduced in size, still a pretty much industrial area. How do you get to cope and some of these questions that come up and in turn interact, I suppose, with your colleagues on the State Board of Education in some of the other counties elsewhere in Indiana, say in central Indiana, where we find more technology-based jobs and related things, certainly involving higher education. How do you get to be able to see how these pathways are going to be able to, be accomplished in some of these other counties of the state?
Well, one of the things, we have great accountability because we are relying heavily and working on this with Indiana's Department of Workforce Development. That's one of the things I think Governor Holcomb has done that's been unique to his tenure, is pretty much bringing together the workforce development community and the education community totally. We're pretty much working hand-in-hand in everything. So we have constant access to their data. For instance, you know, they tell us that by 2020, 65% of all the Hoosier jobs are going to require some type of training beyond high school. So in planning out all of these processes, as well as in assisting school districts to plan out their pathways, we're all working very closely with workforce development and the data they have. So we will be able to see the economic impact as far as jobs, employability, and all of that directly through our interaction with workforce development.
Now, do you and your colleagues on the State Board of Education feel confident that the pathway requirements are going to be able to be ready for the graduating class of 2023 as the goal is?
Oh, I'm confident they're going to be ready before then. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I'm really happy that we did with the pathways is we provided local school districts a lot of flexibility in terms of developing their own locally created pathways. I made a joke at one of our meetings that, hey, maybe Carmel will come up with the career professional tennis pathway. But
well, that's possible.
Up here, I'll say maybe Munster can come up with the professional tennis pathway. But we've given a lot of flexibility for school districts to basically develop this around the resources they have in their communities and the interests of their students. And we have already begun approving locally created pathways. And so I think from what we've been hearing from the field and seeing at our meetings, the school districts are taking this very seriously and getting ahead of it.
Tony Walker, thank you very much for spending time with us to explain what has been discussed in much detail. Hope to have you back again soon. Tony Walker is a Northwest Indiana representative from the State Board of Education. And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Former FBI Director James Comey will be the first speaker on September 9th to kick off the 2018 Purdue Northwest Sinai Forum Series. What's the rest of the season going to be like? Well, Leslie Plezak was with us on Regionally Speaking to give us the rundown, beginning with a famous photographer speaking in early October.
Really, really excited about hosting Kat Hahn. And he, his name is Platon Antonio. He goes by Platon. And he actually, after working for British Vogue for several years, he was invited to New York City to work for the late John Kennedy Jr. in his political magazine, George, if you remember that. And Platon has taken photos for a number of very recognizable publications, including the New York Times Magazine, Vanity Fair, Esquire, GQ, and the list goes on. But he's probably most known for he has over 20 covers on Time Magazine, and one in particular that I think most of us are familiar with was the image of Vladimir Putin when he was Time Magazine's Person of the Year back in 2007. And he is a storyteller, so he talks about his portrait. The title of his talk is called Powerful Portrait, An Intimate Look at Humanity and Leadership. And he really does talk about the person behind the portrait, how he got the portrait. And what I love about him, he came highly recommended from the Richmond, Virginia Forum. Bill Chapman is the executive director there, and he said to me, your audience will laugh, they will cry, they will be really, really mesmerized by his photography. So I'm super excited to bring in Platon on October 7th, and he will be the first speaker on our campus in Westville on October 7th at 4 o'clock. So really excited if you're interested in the arts, if you're interested in politics, very entertaining.
Now, on October 28th, another Sunday, we have Reshma Sajani, who I guess is talking about women, technology, and leadership. Tell us more about her and how she's going to be able to approach these topics when she comes to speak.
Okay. So Reshma Sajani is definitely a mover and a shaker, and I think we're going to hear more about her. But she is the founder and CEO of a national nonprofit called Girls Who Code. And Girls Who Code is working to close the gender gap in technology. So if you consider the number of differences between men and women, often in the sciences and technology and computer technology fields, there is a discrepancy. And so in 2012, this organization was started to teach girls both in middle school and high school coding skills. But what's amazing about it is that she has realized that it goes much deeper. And so she talks about how boys and girls are socialized differently and look at challenges and opportunities differently. And she's a great speaker. I think she's going to be really entertaining. She's going to talk about gender equity, which certainly is another timely topic for us. So I'm really excited about Reshma joining us on Sunday, October 28th.
That's right. Now, on November 11th, another political speaker, or we should say not necessarily political in nature, but he's certainly keeping his eye on the political science field, is Robert Costa. And people may recognize his name and maybe even his face by watching him on public television. Tell us what Robert does what's he going to talk about?
Yeah, so Robert Costa also has a tie to the area that he's a Notre Dame grad. And so he is the title of his talk is called Inside 2018, Understanding the Midterm Elections. So he's speaking on November 11th, which is the Sunday after the midterm elections. And he's really going to help us analyze and break down what we see happen in the midterm elections. There's lots of conversation about what might happen, and he will cover that with us. So he's a national political reporter. He writes for the Washington Post, and he was recently named the moderator of PBS's Washington Week. He's a regular on Meet the Press. He's a regular on Morning Joe. And I think that he is kind of a younger and up-and-coming political analyst. So he's going to join us on the stage to answer our questions, to take a look in almost real time at what happens during the midterm elections.
Now, finally, on December 2nd, on Sunday, December 2nd, Coach Lou Holtz is coming to town. And of course, anybody who is either an Irish student or fan, a faculty member, anybody who appreciates the University of Notre Dame will definitely want to hear what this legendary coach has to say, I'm sure.
We have an afternoon planned with legendary Coach Lou Holtz, and his topic is Game Plan for Success. And Lou Holtz has really established himself as one of the most successful college football coaches of our time. And he is also known as one of the great speakers of our time. So people that have seen him before, I've not seen him, but they've told me that he is inspirational, entertaining, and leaves people very, very moved. And I think when you look at the roster of speakers who have spoken at the Sinai Forum over our 65-year history, Lou Holtz certainly belongs there. He has taken six different teams to bowl games. He's won five bowl games with different teams. And, you know, he's probably most known for what he was able to do at Notre Dame when he took them it talks about taking them from not so good to pretty amazing. And so I think it's not really that he's going to be talking about sports, but I think Lou Holtz applies lessons from the field to our lives in general. And I think people will certainly not be disappointed if they join us on December 2nd to hear Lou Holtz speak.
Now, Leslie, as we wrap up here, once again, give us the website where people can find out more about not only the speakers and the series, but find out how they can get their season tickets.
Basically, what you can do, the easiest way to find out about tickets is go to Purdue Northwest's website, which is pnw.edu. And then if you search in the little search bar for Sinai Forum, it'll take you to our page. And there are several tabs. There's a FAQ tab, frequently asked questions. So everything that you want to know about the forum, how tickets are sold, how do I get my tickets, how much do tickets cost. One thing I do want to point out is that students, both high school and college students, not just Purdue students, but any students with a valid student ID are welcome to attend our programs free of charge. The COMI program does require a student RSVP. That link is on our website as well. No cost, but just an RSVP so we know that we're expecting you.
That's Leslie Plesak of Purdue University Northwest Sinai Forum. And season tickets, by the way, are going quickly for the 65th season of Speakers. That's it for Regionally Speaking, Reporters Roundtable Thursday. Thank you for joining us, and thanks to our reporters with us today, Bill Dolan and Giles Bruce of The Times. And we hope you'll join us next week.